is 1A. I'm Celeste Headlee in Maryland. Happy Juneteenth. On this date in 1865, General Gordon Granger announced that all slaves in Texas were free. June 19th has been celebrated ever since among Black communities with food festivals and street fairs, cookouts, and Miss Juneteenth contests. Meanwhile, across the rest of the nation, protesters continue to march in the streets demanding reform. And in response, several cities, including Boston and Los Angeles, have pledged to reduce funding for their police departments. The Supreme Court has dropped consequential decisions that will affect millions of LGBTQ workers and hundreds of thousands of immigrants. And in the background of all this, the virus continues its destructive work. At least 10 states report surges in COVID cases this week. There is so much to talk about, and we have three very smart people to hash through all of it with us. Molly Ball is a national political correspondent with Time and political analyst for CNN. Great to have you, Molly. David Gura is a correspondent for NBC News and an anchor at MSNBC. Thanks for being with us, David.
Glad to be here.
And making her 1A debut, welcome Kimberly Atkins. She's a senior Washington correspondent for WBUR. Kimberly, welcome.
Hi, Celeste.
All right, we need to start from the Supreme Court. The most recent decision was a 5-4 split. The Supreme Court rejected the Trump administration's attempt to end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, also known as DACA. So, Kimberly, there are an estimated 3 to 4 million people who fit the Dreamer profile, came to the country as children, and have been in the past in danger of deportation. How does this impact them?
Yes. So right now, at the time that this case was pending, there were just under 700,000 of these individuals, young people who were brought into the country when they were very young by their parents or others, who had enrolled in DACA, which essentially gives them the ability to work, to go to school, to join the military with temporary permanent status in order to do that. And as you said, there are about 3 million people who would qualify. The battle over President Trump's move to rescind DACA has been going on for years now. So one result of that is that fewer people have been enrolling. So it remains to be seen if the federal government is going to allow new applications to be processed by because of this ruling. President Trump has tweeted that he intends to rescind it again, which under the Supreme Court decision, he can do. The Supreme Court did not rule on the constitutionality of DACA. It just ruled that the way it was rescinded was wrong.
I want to dig into that tweet, which just occurred like within the past 20 minutes or so. This is something that the president tweeted out today. Quote, the Supreme Court asked us to resubmit on DACA. Nothing was lost or won. They punted, much like in a football game where hopefully they would stand for our great American flag. We will be submitting enhanced papers shortly in order to properly fulfill the Supreme Court's ruling and request of yesterday. David, before we get to the second part, which was about the Democrats, let's parse through this. This idea that they're going to submit enhanced papers. What are enhanced papers?
I think your guess is as good as mine, but picking up on what Kimberly was saying, this was a decision that was made on procedural grounds. It was a provisional decision. So this isn't wholly settled. I think you could say, and I defer to Kimberly, who's an actual lawyer on this, but I think the larger issue here is just how unclear the president has been about where he stands on DACA. And from the tweet that you read there, you know, he talks about how he wants to do something for the Dreamers. He's been somebody who's wanted to see this remedied in some way, and yet that sort of flies in the face of what happened back in 2017 when he pulled out the rug from under this, making the case essentially that what President Obama did was beyond the powers of the presidency. So it just seems like another policy issue, another facet of this administration where there just isn't a whole lot of clarity on where he stands on the particular issue. So again, this being a procedural decision, I suppose that, you know, he could do more to explain where he stands, explains how he, the administration, feels about the legality of this program. But as is the case over and over again, 280 characters doesn't leave room for the kind of clarity I think that you need to figure out where they're going with this.
Yeah, well, then, Kimberly, let's dig into the second half of this, which David referred to. He said, I have wanted to take care of DACA recipients better than the do-nothing Democrats, but for 2 years they refused to negotiate. They have abandoned DACA. Based on the decision the Dems can't make DACA citizens, they gained nothing. Kimberly, can you walk us through how true or maybe spun some of this is?
Yeah, I mean, keep in mind that immigration reform is and has been for many, many years the most thorniest of subjects on Capitol Hill. And attempts to come to some sort of immigration reform, whether broad or something more narrow, like just addressing Dreamers, has time and again, if it got anywhere, it would fizzle at the finish line. And in this case, there is no difference. The Democrats have introduced legislation that would essentially codify DACA, make it law, and provide not only the ability for these young people to stay in the country legally, but also make a path towards citizenship for them if they meet certain criteria. And that has really been a non-starter for Republicans. So it is more than a little disingenuous for the president to paint himself as a champion of these Dreamers and the Democrats standing in the way. The president could have, of course, chosen not to rescind DACA too, and we wouldn't be having this discussion. So immigration is seen for Donald Trump as a campaign issue that helps motivate and galvanize his base. So the idea that he's pushing to broaden immigration laws in this sense, it's just not true.
So DACA was not the only big Supreme Court decision this week. The day before a Supreme Court decision confirmed LGBTQ protections in the workplace, activists flooded into Brooklyn. And I mean flooded. The pictures are astounding. They were there to support Black trans people.
Black lives matter!
Black trans lives matter!
Black trans power matters!
Black trans power matters!
Organizers estimate about 15,000 people participated, and then the 6-3 decision dropped Monday. Justice Neil Gorsuch led the court in saying the 1964 Civil Rights Act also protects gay and transgender people from workplace discrimination. Molly, how does this decision play out? I guess, what are the broader implications of it?
Well, the most immediate implication, of course, is that the Supreme Court has decreed that gay and trans people, LGBTQ people, cannot be fired for their sexual orientation or gender identity, which is a really big deal. This is something that the activists have been trying to get legislated for a really long time. And so it's a big case for that reason. Many states and localities already had laws protecting those people, but many did not. So this evens the playing field in that sense. And I think, as you alluded to, it also changes a lot of people's perception of this particular court and of Justice Gorsuch, especially people who really follow, you know, the legal theory here weren't all that surprised, in part because of how Gorsuch indicated he was interpreting the arguments during the oral argument, and in part because Gorsuch is known in the legal community as a textualist and a bit of a libertarian. So his prerogative on all of this was, it sort of doesn't matter what the lawmakers who made this statute had in mind if the plain text of the law says what it says. So it's a really interesting decision for, I think, you know, certainly the popular perception of this court has been that it is just extremely conservative and the conservative majority, but justices don't necessarily see themselves as politicians in that way, and you can get some interesting verdicts.
David, we have about a minute here. Could you give us an idea of what other important decisions we're expecting?
You know, there are a handful left here in this term. I must admit I don't have them off the top of my head, but I think that to what Molly was saying, a lot of people are trying to read the tea leaves here based on these two decisions, based on how Neil Gorsuch wrote that opinion and Justice Roberts wrote his opinion. And, you know, I'll echo what Molly said. I think that it's really anyone's guess sort of what happens as a result of this. And I think there's only so much that you can read in from these two decisions to see where this court goes. And you see that even in what the president tweeted yesterday, his dissatisfaction with the composition of this court. I think he's as flummoxed as all of us would be by kind of how, you know, justices do have these appointments for life, and they aren't as subject to the political winds as others. So I think there is still much more to come.
Yeah, it's difficult to know once they get onto the court. And we are expecting decisions on the president's tax returns, for example, and abortion. Lots of major rulings expected in the next week or so. Still to come, we're going to talk about how the Senate and House bills on police reform differ, maybe how they're the same, whether they're likely to pass. We're talking with David Gura. He's a correspondent for NBC News and an anchor at MSNBC. Also, Molly Ball is a national political correspondent with Time and political analyst for CNN. And Kimberly Atkins is a senior Washington correspondent with WBUR. You're listening to 1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor LegalZoom. We're all faced with new challenges these days. If you need legal help for yours, count on LegalZoom. Have questions about setting up a will or a living trust? Do you want to start a business as a DBA or LLC? LegalZoom can help. You can start online, and their network of attorneys can provide advice when you need it. And since LegalZoom isn't a law firm, you don't have to leave your home, and you won't get charged by the hour. Visit LegalZoom.com today for more information.
Hey, y'all, I'm Sam Sanders, host of It's Been a Minute. There is a lot going on in the world. So on my show, my guest and I make sense of the news and culture through conversation. It feels like we're living in three movies at once.
That's a good way to put it.
It feels like a Mike Judge movie. It feels like a Spike Lee movie. And it feels like a Michael Bay movie. Like
Every Tuesday and Friday, listen and subscribe now to It's Been a Minute from NPR.
I'm Celeste Headlee. We're talking about the top headlines in the nation this week. And with us is Molly Ball, a national political correspondent with Time and political analyst for CNN. David Gura is a correspondent at NBC News and anchor at MSNBC. And Kimberly Atkins, senior Washington correspondent with WBUR. So the protests against police brutality against Black people continue. And in the midst of all that, Rashard Brooks, a Black man, was shot and killed by a white police officer in Atlanta on Friday. Molly, what happened here?
He had apparently had a few drinks and was not driving, had fallen asleep in his car, I believe, and had a lengthy interaction with police that was all caught on video, most of which proceeded pretty normally. And then at the very last minute, there was a scuffle, and he grabbed one of the officer's tasers and fled and was shot in the back. And the local prosecutor in Atlanta has now charged one of the officers, in an unusual development, one of the officers is actually going to testify against another. Usually there's sort of a blue wall of silence in these cases. It's a really interesting case, has prompted a fresh round of protests, another reminder of how frequently these unfortunate incidents happen, obviously more fuel for these protest movements.
The officer's named Garrett Rolfe. He faces 11 charges. One of them includes murder, and another officer who was on the scene faces some charges. After those charges were announced, police officers in Atlanta called out sick in very high numbers, and some of them did not call in sick, but they started refusing to show up on calls. Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms would not confirm how many officers called out. Here she is speaking to CNN Wednesday night.
We do have enough officers to cover us through the night. And our streets won't be any less safe because of the number of officers who've called out. But it's just my hope, again, that our officers will remember the commitment that they made when they held up their hand and they were sworn in as police officers.
However, David, the police chief did resign over this. Is there any indication of how this might go?
You know, I think there are a lot of people who are rightly skeptical of whether or not this local prosecutor, the Fulton County District Attorney, would be able to get a guilty charge here on that felony murder charge, certainly, in light of what Molly was just saying. The historical strength of that blue line. But I think that this is another example of just how remarkable it is to have the kind of footage of this that we've seen. I mean, the images are searing. It's really wrenching to watch the whole video. As Molly said, you know, the first few minutes of this start out with Rashard Brooks speaking with the officer, explaining what had happened, and then things really take a turn, and it's a dramatic turn to be sure. But I think that that's a through line through all of these stories that we've seen in recent months. Yes, this is a story with a much longer history than that, but to have images of this as searing as they are, I think really changes the conversation here. And you know, with this case, with any number of the ones that we've seen in recent weeks, not of least of which is what led to George Floyd's death. Yeah. I think that the video that we have of these incidents just stand to change how these cases might go when they reach courtrooms.
And the protests, as I mentioned, continue. And one of the main demands by protesters in many cities is to defund the police. So Kimberly, we've talked before about how for many protesters, defunding the police doesn't mean getting rid of police altogether. But a number of cities have chosen to decrease police budgets. Do you think this is becoming a trend?
It very well may be. And you are right. Yes, defund police does not mean abolish police, but it means take action that has been taken by a number of police departments, such as Boston, which plans to divert millions of dollars in what would otherwise have gone to paying police overtime to other community-based programs in order to take the police out of certain instances, including an instance, for example, if somebody is asleep in a car, the argument is that may not even be a police situation. If you don't call the police, that person would not end up getting shot by police, and that this is one way to tackle reform. Of course, this is a political issue. We've seen the president and others really denounce this idea of defunding police, calling it anti-police, which, you know, as we pointed out, that's not what it is. But, you know, we keep coming to this problem over and over again. For years, we have been seeing the killing of unarmed Black people by police. And so for some leaders in some cities, they realize that something new needs to be done. It's not just enough to have body cameras. It's not just enough to have training, that some other reforms are needed. And we're seeing that take place at a local level.
David, I wonder if you could address this comment from a listener in Woodbridge, Virginia. Joanne says, please talk about the protesters being attacked by militias in the West. There have been several articles in the Washington Post about militias threatening not only protesters, but business owners in small Western towns in Idaho, Montana, and Oregon. David, what is Joanne talking about here?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen stories about that. I haven't reported out any of them myself, but I think that they're has been this sense that there have been groups that have infiltrated what have otherwise been peaceful protests. We certainly saw that coming to the fore in New York a few weeks back. There were comments from local officials here that people were coming from outside to mix things up or agitate again in those peaceful protests. And, you know, I think that that very well may be the case in other places. And, you know, we look at what might happen here in Tulsa, the president tweeting today that they won't have any tolerance for rioting or anything that happened in cities like New York and Minneapolis. You know, I think that there is a sense that these protest movements have been altered or changed, or the messaging may have been changed by those who've come in from outside. So again, I've seen what Joanne's referring to. I don't know well enough to say whether or not, in fact, that is happening. But there is a concern that these groups are being infiltrated by those who are not party to the message that most of the protesters are advancing.
Although we did have the incident in New Mexico when a man is accused of shooting a protester in Albuquerque. That protester was in critical condition yesterday, at least. They have dropped the charges a little bit down from the very extreme count of aggravated battery, but we have seen clashes. I wanted to go to a little bit of the politics. There is a 6-block protest zone in Seattle that has drawn the attention of the president and really riled him up.
The police are somehow told not to be there. I'm sure they'd do a good job if they were told to do a good job. I assume they're properly trained. But we would go in there if they want us in, and we will take it back very quickly. It should never be allowed to fester like it's festering right now. It's disgraceful to our country. It's a disgrace.
That's what President Trump told Fox News on Wednesday night. Molly, what is going on with that protest zone in Seattle, and why is the president worried about it?
Yeah, I mean, as you said before, this is a 6-block zone in a very liberal neighborhood in downtown Seattle. I actually used to live there briefly a long time ago, in that neighborhood of Capitol Hill, and they have declared it an autonomous area, free from police. The idea being that the local residents can better and more responsibly take care of their own safety. And this is another thing that you sometimes hear from the police abolitionist movement, is that local communities are better suited to guarantee their own safety than the police, which have been regarded in many neighborhoods as sort of an occupying and a hostile force. But the larger political valence is probably the more significant thing here. And as you mentioned, you know, the president has sought to put out the idea that these are, you know, violent anarchists who are sort of overthrowing the recognized authorities, and it's of a piece with his continued hammering on this idea that liberals and Democrats broadly want to eliminate police overall and just get rid of law enforcement, and they hate law enforcement. And I think we can expect this to be a major theme of the reelection campaign. His first campaign was very, very much about that slogan of law and order, invoking, you know, Nixon in 68. In 2018, a lot of the Republican ads were about stoking these fears, whether it was, you know, caravan sanctuary cities or this idea of like violent protests. So trying to evoke, you know, the urban disorder, especially of an earlier era, to sort of convince people that they need protection.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing how quickly news moves. I had completely forgotten about all of those caravan ads about the dangerous caravan coming up from Central and Southern America. And you're right, they were plastered all over everywhere you looked. But Kimberly, the president has really gone after the governor of Washington and the mayor of Seattle over this. What has been the response from the leadership in Washington State?
Yeah, you know, this sets up one of those clashes, the culture wars that the president tends to wage. He sees that as politically advantageous to really decry local officials who say, hey, you know, look at the mess that you have in these cities. And the implication is if you allow particularly Democratic rule, that the entire country is going to turn into the thing that he's described. When in most cases, the thing that he's describing isn't chaos, it's usually something else. And you have local officials who are saying, look, we need to do what's best and what we have to do what's best for our citizens here and make that determination. You are seeing in some areas there was an effort to take down a similar area in Portland, Oregon, after the president started tweeting and talking about that too. Mm-hmm. But this is something that the president likes. The president likes these divisions, these cultural battles that he sees. He sees himself as the law and order president, and it stems directly from his instinct to do things like have the park across from the White House cleared so that he could walk across it, or to demand that governors call active military to their streets to push back against protesters. It's all part and parcel of this approach by the president.
As we mentioned at the top of the show, today is Juneteenth. That is the day that slaves in Texas finally found out that they were free. It's 2 years after Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation. And to be clear, it did not free all slaves. It is also the day that President Trump had planned to resume his rallies, his in-person rallies, and he wanted to begin in Tulsa, Oklahoma. There was a lot of backlash, and the Trump campaign rescheduled that rally for Saturday. Instead, Molly, can you unpack this for us about exactly what has happened between the announcement and the backlash and the new decision?
Yes. Well, so the president and his advisors don't seem to have realized, he said in a couple of recent interviews, that sort of alluded to not really having any idea about Juneteenth. And it was particularly painful for local residents because of the history of racist violence in Tulsa, specifically on
the Tulsa massacre in 1921 that destroyed what was known as Black Wall Street. Keep going.
Exactly. And so it's interesting, you know, this is a president who doesn't ever like to admit that he's wrong or succumb to criticism. But in this case, his advisor did apparently prevail on him to change the date. However, you know, the anniversary and the protests are one concern. And then another concern is that we still have this pandemic going on. And the idea of holding a large indoor event is exactly what all the public health authorities have said is the biggest concern for spreading the virus. And it's really striking how much people around the president talk about this as a matter of his emotional health, talk about how, you know, he's sort of stir crazy there in the White House. I mean, we can all relate to that, I'm sure. But yeah. But that, you know, he needs to get out there and be in front of his people in order to sort of feel better because he's been so discouraged by all of the difficult events of recent months. So he's determined to do this. There's people already camped out, lining up in Tulsa waiting to get in. There seems to be little doubt that there'll be a massive crowd there. Mask wearing is apparently encouraged but not required, and there's actually a clause in the ticket language that people can't sue the Trump campaign if they get sick. So there's potential for this to be, according to the health authorities, quite dangerous, but the venue is privately owned, and some attempts to stop the rally from happening in the courts have not been successful.
Well, David, let's talk a little bit more about, because there was a lawsuit to try to force social distancing that was rejected by the judge. Can you explain a little bit about what's going on and whether there are precautions for COVID?
I mean, there is huge concern about what this might lead to if this could be a super spread event. And Molly said that the arena is privately owned. Even the arena wants there to be some detail, once the campaign provides some detail about how they're going to keep people safe there, keep them apart, do all that they can to maintain physical distancing within the context of that. So we'll see if that leads to anywhere. But as you say, there's a backdrop to this that, yes, the pandemic continues. And you look at the numbers in Oklahoma, they've gone up in recent days, as they have in many states across the country. So I think a lot of people are rightly worried about what this might mean. And yes, it's a, you know, not a huge arena. It's like a 20,000 person arena. But the president has been talking in recent days about how many people requested tickets, how there might be overflow events as well. You know, this is not occurring today, as you said. It was moved because of Juneteenth. But there is so much happening in Tulsa as a result of both Juneteenth and this rally. The Reverend Al Sharpton is holding an event there today, a rally there today. As Molly said, people are lining up already. This has a, you know, I think it could be very bad if you listen to public health officials, including those on the ground in Oklahoma, and public health officials who work for the state were expressing their concerns as well. It's just something the president seems, if not blind to, unwilling to engage with. And as Molly said, there's been this eagerness to get back to doing this, pandemic be damned. And he kind of wishes it away and continues to wish it away. And I think the rest of us just kind of hold our breaths to see what will happen here in the coming weeks.
Yeah. And the Tulsa mayor has declared both a civil emergency and a curfew around the arena area. We're going to talk more about what's going on in the nation. As we go to the break, though, let's hear to some of the terrific fiddle playing from the voice that you just heard, our guest, David Gura. He has been posting video. Don't be humble here, David, because you sound great. He's been posting videos of himself playing on his roof. This particular piece you're going to hear is called North Carolina Breakdown. We are talking to David Gura, the fiddler, and correspondent for NBC News and anchor at MSNBC. Molly Ball is national political correspondent with Time and political analyst for CNN, and Kimberly Atkins is senior Washington correspondent with WBUR. I'm Celeste Headlee. Take it away, David Gura on the fiddle. More from our guests and from you in just a moment. Thank you.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Facebook. In response to COVID-19, people around the world are coming together to help one another. Facebook's community help feature is making that easier. From delivering groceries to neighbors to donating to a local fundraiser or food pantry, community help provides a place where people can offer or request support in their area. Learn more at facebook.com/COVID support.
Throughout America's history, small choices have compounded into big inequalities. I'm Manoush Zomorodi. How Injustice Gets Ingrained. That's on the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Subscribe or listen now.
We're talking about the national news headlines, and we're doing it with David Gura, correspondent of NBC News, anchor at MSNBC, Kimberly Atkins, senior Washington correspondent with WBUR, and Molly Ball, national political correspondent with Time and a political analyst for CNN. Let's talk about some brand names that are familiar to so many of them of us, because some brands that have their either their logos, their names, or images rooted in racism are now rethinking those images. Quaker Oats is eliminating the Aunt Jemima syrup brand. No word yet on what might replace it. Mars has followed suit with its Uncle Ben's brand. We've heard the same about Mrs. Butterworth. David Gura, any idea what caused these sudden changes? Because people have been asking for that to happen for a long time.
Yeah, this is a long time coming, and there is an insidious long history with regard to what happened here with Aunt Jemima. But as you say, there are a host of other brands, a host of other logos and name brands that have not changed. Maybe we'll see that happen as a result. But I think it's just another indication of the moment that we're in, that these things have been talked about for so long. Letters have been written about this to companies. Campaigns have been waged to get them to change their names, change their branding. Have been happening for decades and decades. It hasn't happened. So I think that people are rightfully optimistic that more is going to change now. I had some toast for breakfast today and took out some Land O'Lakes butter, not to do a name brand placement here on the show.
But go ahead and name the brands.
They've changed their logo in recent weeks as
well. They used to have a woman with a Native American
woman in the middle of it, and that's been removed. So the branding remains the same, except she's now absent from it. So I think that it is just part of this greater moment that people are beginning to look around with eyes perhaps wider open than they have been, and are beginning to agitate for this kind of change. I think that what happened with Aunt Jemima was there was a social media campaign, a TikTok video that gathered a lot of steam, and as you say, Quaker Oats, which is owned by PepsiCo, took notice of the fact that there was this sort of ferment bubbling over, and people wanted to see this change. But this is a brand that's been around for decades and decades. So yeah. As I say, it was a long time coming, and I think most should rightly agree it was a good thing that it's finally happened.
Kimberly, what other brands do you think might be reconsidering? And I say this being not too far away from where the Washington Redskins play. Do you think this might spread?
It could. It certainly, particularly with the NFL being at the center of a debate about race and having Roger Goodell do a 180 when it comes to his stance on players protesting on the field, that reckoning and the moment that we find ourselves in would put pressure on the Washington football team to reconsider its logo. As David said, it just shows how pervasive racist imagery and characterizations have become in our society at a time. I mean, the change in thought about it. I mean, I remember when I was a child and I watched Gone with the Wind, for example, and I see it today, it seems very different. And there is a discussion about that film as well. And I think we are going to continue to see people think about Confederate monuments and other things as part of the moment of reckoning that the nation finds itself in.
Let's talk about politics, shall we? There are two possibly competing legislative packages that take on the idea of police reform. One comes from the Democrats in the House, the other comes from the Republicans in the Senate, and we got more details on the Republican proposal this week. Tell us, Molly, what are the key differences between these two proposals?
Yeah, well, there are some key similarities I would point out first. It's interesting that a lot of the national, at least the federal legislative conversation has sort of congealed around some similar ideas Both the Democratic and Republican bills have mechanisms for increasing data collection about officer misconduct, and both of them have provisions on chokeholds. The Democrats' bill goes farther in both respects, making both of those provisions more mandatory. But it is really remarkable, I think, and indicative of the way the public conversation has changed on these things, that both parties see the need to act on this in an election year. It seems urgent to show that they're trying to do something. Now, I'm never an optimist when it comes to the possibility for bipartisanship or for anything to get done in Washington. I'm not naive. But it's interesting that both parties are saying they want to do something and are introducing some relatively similar things, although the devil is always in the details. The Democrats' bill also includes provisions on qualified immunity, the doctrine that protects most police officers from being subject to lawsuits in many instances. And it includes a ban on no-knock warrants, whereas the Republican bill would study the issue but would not actually ban that practice, which so infamously was implicated in the recent killing of Breonna Taylor. So a lot of differences in these bills, and also in the executive order that the president signed. The president doesn't have the ability to go as far as the legislature can in terms of changing the law. But Democrats have been critical of the executive order, saying that it's window dressing because it doesn't go as far as either of these yeah. bills. So, but it remains to be seen whether the political will is sufficient to actually move something forward now.
We're going to continue talking about this, but we got a question from a listener that I can actually answer. Michael emails, will Cracker Jacks change their name? I happen to know the answer to this, Michael. The name Cracker Jacks came supposedly from a customer who ate them and said, well, that's really a Cracker Jack. Cracker Jack was also a phrase that meant like something that was really awesome. So it's not that the origin of that name is not actually racist in tone. Whether they change it, I have no idea. I'm not on the board there. David, can we talk a little bit about the political expectations here about what may happen with either the proposal from the Democrats in the House or the Republicans in the Senate? Do they have a chance of being signed by President Trump?
You know, I share some of Molly's pessimism about the prospect for there being bipartisanship in Washington, and you know, now being removed from Washington, I have even more of a feeling toward that being gone. But you know, I think that Senate Democrats kind of have a dilemma right now on their hands as Tim Scott's bill, this Justice Act, is what they're going to be debating. Do they back that, even if it is not as comprehensive a piece of legislation as they would want to have, just to do something? I do marvel at the fact that the Senate Majority Leader, who has a tendency to move pretty glacially when it comes to legislation, has indicated that he wants to bring this up pretty quickly for a vote for the Senate to take it up. So I think that there is in the background a recognition of the fact that most Americans want there to be some progress made on this. I am among those who sighs when I hear that, you know, the end result of this might just be more studies of some of this stuff. But I do think that there is something to the sort of growing demand or growing desire for lawmakers in Congress and for the president, just for the government, to do something to deal with this. You look at the hearing that the Senate Judiciary Committee had this week. It was a committee hearing that did not involve the Attorney General. So it still seems pretty piecemeal. It still doesn't seem comprehensive to me. And again, I'm not optimistic that we're going to see kind of level of comprehensiveness that is kind of demanded by this moment anytime soon.
Frankly, if you're a political correspondent for any longer than about 6 months, I found optimism doesn't usually survive.
That's too bad.
Just FYI. Kimberly, let's talk about social media's interactions, especially with the president, because Facebook removed several ads from the Trump campaign this week, quote, for violating our policy against organized hate. And Twitter has pushed back on some of the president's tweets recently. Just, I think yesterday, added manipulated message on one of the president's tweets. What's happening here? Are we seeing a change that may last among the social media platforms?
Yeah, we're seeing social media platforms, which has been under fire for a while now, for their complicity in advancing false and fake news, so to speak. If you think about the term fake news, it really came into the lexicon in 2016 to refer to ads or other things that were posted on Facebook or Twitter that had false or misleading information in it, but that by the time you could even correct it or address it, it had already been shared thousands or millions of times on these social media platforms. And there's been an increased pressure by Congress and by others to hold these social media platforms accountable. We've seen them take incremental steps, Twitter more so than Facebook, and it includes the political arena with ads, and in this case, there was an ad that was deemed to have Nazi symbols within this ad by the Trump administration. There was also a video that President Trump himself tweeted yesterday that purported to claim that CNN was manipulating video to make his campaign look bad, when the video itself was actually manipulated in a way that wasn't true. By the way, it was the attempt was to use a video which I think everybody else has seen a billion times of a white child and a black child embracing. So yeah, you would think if they would try to fool someone, they would take one that was a little less known. But it's this clash. But at the same time, it feeds into yet another battle that the president loves to wage, which is his claim that social media is anti-conservative. It's against him. It's against his supporters, and is attempting to try to silence their speech. So the actions that they take only fuel the political clash there.
Yeah. We have another question from a listener. I have no idea why I have all this arcane knowledge about the origin of names, but a listener asked, what about Cracker Barrel, referring to the restaurant? I happen to know the origin of that name is that country stores used to have actual barrels of crackers, the soda crackers, saltines. They would have actual barrels of them often in the very, very front of the store, and that is where the origin of that name comes from. Again, let's move on. Let's talk about the Democrats here for a moment. We got news that Senator Amy Klobuchar has dropped out of the running for Joe Biden's VP pick, and she has said specifically she wants that position to go to a woman of color instead. David, what does this mean, and is it a dig at Elizabeth Warren?
It certainly makes things complicated for Elizabeth Warren, who is on this short list of women. Vice President Joe Biden has said that he would pick a woman to be his vice president. He said that during a debate. Makes things thorny for her. So Senator Amy Klobuchar went on my colleague's show, on Lawrence O'Donnell's show last night, and said that this moment kind of demands him to pick a woman of color. She said, if you want to heal this nation, this would be a hell of a way to do it. I'm synthesizing or paraphrasing what she had to say there. She had been on that short list. I think there were like 9 or 10 names on this list of potential candidates to be Joe Biden's running mate. It makes things difficult for Elizabeth Warren because she is not a woman of color, but she is by all accounts high up on that list of women that the former vice president is considering to be a running mate. Amy Klobuchar is in an interesting position here. She was a prosecutor in Minnesota. Obviously, a lot of the protests and events of recent weeks have taken place in Minnesota. That has subjected her to some scrutiny. It was certainly an interesting move, certainly advanced this conversation more. I think these things tend to play out publicly in kind of an odd way until the decision is made. And I'm not sure what we're going to learn until the final decision is made. I don't foresee a whole lot of action until then.
We got to talk about John Bolton. The former national security advisor is coming out with a memoir that's called In the Room Where It Happened. It describes his 18 months in the Trump White House. We've got about 2 minutes here, so maybe I can get Molly to tell me your key takeaways here. There's a lot of takeaways. What are the important ones for you?
There's the substance of what is described in the book. Bolton describes a number of extremely alarming incidents, including a lot of information, firsthand information to back up the case about Ukraine that was made in impeachment. He criticizes the Democrats for not pursuing other things that the president did, for instance, in China. But then the way the book has been received is also amazing. I mean, anyone who's followed John Bolton's career knows that he's always had a talent for this. He's managed to
make everybody mad. He's managed to really annoy both the Democrats and the Republicans. The Republicans don't like the way he's turned on Trump and been critical, and there's a lot of criticism from him. For him from within the administration and from Congress. And then the Democrats are accusing him of having sat on this information when he could have testified in impeachment or at another time, instead holding on to this information until it became opportune for him to try to sell books. So John Bolton may be the most disliked man in Washington these days, and the Trump administration continues to try to prevent the book from being published, even though it's already been shipped out, even though all of these juicy morsels are already in the public stream. There's a First Amendment case before the court trying to prevent the book from being officially released.
We might as well hear just a little bit of John Bolton himself. Here he is in an interview with ABC News that'll air in full on Sunday.
I don't think he's fit for office. I don't think he has the competence to carry out the job. There really isn't any guiding principle that I was able to discern other than what's good for Donald Trump's reelection.
We had a lot of news to get through, and we got it through as much as we could. We have been talking to Molly Ball. She is a national political correspondent with Time and also a political analyst for CNN. David Gura is correspondent for NBC News and also anchor on MSNBC. And Kimberly Atkins is a senior Washington correspondent with WBUR. Thanks to all three of you for joining us this week. A reminder to our listeners, we do have a text club. We will only ever send you one text a day, but it is the fastest way to connect with us, and you can get details about how to sign up for that in the Ask 1A tab at the1a.org. 1A's socially distant lead audio engineer and sound designer is Jake Cherry. He gets technical assistance from Ben Privett and Rashad Young. Aileen Humphreys is the producer and editor of 1A On Demand. Gabrielle Healy is our digital editor, and Chris Castano is our digital producer. Stay with us for the international section of our news roundup right after this. This is 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Kay Buxbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments. Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
This is 1A. I'm Celeste Headlee, and it's time for the international edition of our news roundup. We'll catch up on some of the biggest stories happening overseas this week. Yes, the pandemic is still very much with us. Globally, there are now almost 8.5 million cases. More than 450,000 people have died. But there are some other big stories coming out of the Philippines, India, and China, and the U.S., already very busy with the events occurring here at home, has also been plenty busy on the world stage. Our guests this week are Nick Schifrin, foreign affairs and defense correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. Nick, welcome back.
Thanks very much for having me.
Laura Seligman, Pentagon reporter with Politico. Likewise, Laura, thanks for making time for us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And from the Washington Post, Ishan Tharoor. Ishan is a columnist on the foreign desk and runs the Today's Worldview newsletter for the Post. Ishan, good to have you back.
Pleasure to be here.
Let's start high in the Himalayas. This week, there was a deadly fight between Indian and Chinese forces that's close to a disputed border. It left at least 20 Indian soldiers dead. We're talking about the two most populous nations in the world with two of the planet's biggest military forces. They have been battling out for weeks, diplomatically and obviously literally. Ishan, what's going on here?
Well, as you said, these are the two most populous nations in the world. They share a long, over 2,000-mile border high up in the Himalayas in very rugged, very remote terrain. And this border has been the site of many disputes over the years. But what happened this week is alarming because of the loss of life. Our understanding of the events are based largely on Indian military reporting. The Chinese have been very quiet about what happened. But this is a part of a longstanding escalation that's been taking place over the past few weeks. And it seems that in some kind of melee, at least 20 Indian troops died, and there's an untold number of Chinese casualties. It's the first known loss of life for Indian soldiers along the border with China in almost half a century. And it comes at a time of tremendous sort of rising nationalist sentiment within India, and a sense that China, as it is in other parts of Asia, is taking an increasingly emboldened, assertive stance on its borders. And so it's yeah. part of this larger matrix of tensions.
We should say, just in the interest of full disclosure, you have family ties to Indian politics, correct?
Oh, yes. My father is in the opposition. But this is a sort of a bipartisan affair in India as well.
Laura, India's Prime Minister Modi responded and said these deaths will not be in vain. What does that mean?
Yeah, so this is a really tricky situation for Prime Minister Modi. He wants to project an image of strength and has been fanning this wave of nationalism that's overtaken India the last couple years. For example, last year, there was a situation where Indian forces were attacked in an event linked to Pakistan, and Modi ordered airstrikes, and this helped propel him to a landslide re-election victory. But this case is different. He's very much aware that China's military is much more powerful than Pakistan's, and he doesn't, I don't believe, want a war. So Modi is going to use a mix of tactics this time, including economic and diplomatic. But of course, also complicating matters is that the countries rely on each other for trade. The India-China trade is more than $95 billion in 2018. So what does Modi do here? It seems like he might take some economic jabs at China in the meantime. On Thursday, there were reports that India was preparing to cancel a huge railway contract that was given to a Chinese company. So right now, I think people are hoping that the violence simmers out and there aren't any more flare-ups, but really more to come.
Nick, you have reported a lot on China. I wonder, why do we see this action, violence, on this border that has been disputed for so long? Why is this happening now?
I think most senior officials in the U.S. and Delhi at this point would say that the nationalism is not just in India. The nationalism is in China. And as Sean pointed out quite well, China has been much, much more aggressive in general across the world, diplomatically, economically, militarily, but especially along its borders. And so this is an example of that. And the Indian officials I talked to cite specifically that Chinese troops moved into a specific part of the land that overlooks a strategically important road. And that's an example of China becoming more aggressive. And to Laura's point, what does India do, right? Does this accelerate the strategic alliance that Washington has been trying to build with India against China? Does it accelerate what the U.S. calls the Quad, which is India, Australia, Japan, and Washington? And is Modi willing to take steps against China? Not only, you know, maybe tariffs, blocking Huawei, those railroad contracts that Laura mentioned. So this is a really important moment for what the U.S. has been trying to do with China and for India's relationship in its backyard.
Well, to add a data point to this discussion, President Trump signed a measure Wednesday that could sanction Chinese officials for their role in interning ethnic Uyghurs. The headline goes on to the claim by former National Security Advisor John Bolton in the memoir that's coming out. Bolton said Donald Trump told President Xi Jinping that he would back the construction of camps to forcibly re-educate Muslim minorities. So, Laura, Bolton obviously is interested in book sales. Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, says this is all a lie, the story that Bolton related. What are we to make of this? Because if it's true, it's incredible.
Yeah, that's true. And Bolton seems to have made everybody angry this time with this book. Republicans are accusing him of being a traitor and making up stories, while Democrats are angry he waited for the book payoff instead of telling his story to the American public during impeachment. But as you said, this is really one of the most controversial claims in the book, that Trump told President Xi Jinping that he endorsed the detention camps where he has imprisoned hundreds of thousands, if not a million, of China's minority Uyghur Muslim population. So as you said, Bolton wrote that Trump said to go ahead with building the camps, that it's exactly the right thing to do, and that he wouldn't sanction China because of this. And this is really interesting in terms of where the president's relationship with China has been and has evolved over the past couple of years. He's obviously been trying to make a trade deal, but it also wraps into his larger effort, which Bolton revealed in the book, to try to get China to help him with his re-election chances by investing in American goods. So it seems like it's all in the mix here. But now it's really interesting that his administration has kind of turned around. And on actually the day that the report about John Bolton's memoir came out, the president, like you said, signed a bill that aims to eventually, potentially, sanction Chinese officials for a myriad of human rights abuses, including the camps, but not limited to the camps. So this is an interesting symbolic step right now. It may signal a shift. It may just signal that the Trump administration has been frustrated by its relationship with China and China's refusal to do a deal and continue its behavior in the South China Sea and aggressive moves with Huawei. But really, this particular move may be too little too late.
So, Ishan, we have this tweet from one of our listeners named Gerard, and I wondered if you could answer Gerard. Gerard says, more than ever, the relationship between the U.S. and China looks as a self-fulfilling prophecy of a new Cold War. On one side, self-righteousness, and on the other, authoritarian paranoia. Can't they calmly talk in terms of interests back to the mediocre field of compromises?
That's a great question. And what we have seen, especially under the Trump administration, but also in the past couple of years in China with Xi Jinping's tightening sort of authoritarian grip and assertiveness in his neighborhood, is a hardening ideological confrontation. There's this sense, especially in Washington, that China, and this is a bipartisan view, that China is a real threat in the decades to come. There is, on the part of the Trump administration, and what's fascinating about this Bolton book is that it underscores yet again some of the dissonance between Trump and officials in his administration and lawmakers in Congress. You know, people in Washington have been talking about what's happening in Xinjiang quite vocally. And people like Mike Pompeo and Mike Pence, his vice president, have postured quite a lot about the plight of the Uyghurs. You know, this is probably the Muslim community that the Trump administration cares about the most, at least in its public statements around the world. And for Trump to sort of be undercutting that is not surprising, but also quite interesting because it undercuts also this growing sense of an ideological confrontation. Whether we're in a new Cold War, of course, that's a very loaded analogy.
Yeah.
And one that has been bandied about a lot by experts in various parts of the world.
Yeah.
I don't think that's a scenario that people believe, you know, is really fully underway.
Yeah.
But indeed, in terms of the way the U.S. is positioning itself in Asia, it's all along the lines of confrontation and a slightly tense competition.
So President Trump has apparently run out of patience with Germany, at least when it comes to NATO. The president seems irritated at how little Berlin gives to NATO, and he says he's moving forward with plans to withdraw thousands of troops from that country.
So we're protecting Germany and they're delinquent. That doesn't make sense. So I said we're going to bring down the soldier count to 25,000 soldiers. And as you know, those are well-paid soldiers. They live in Germany. They spend vast amounts of money in Germany. Everywhere around those bases is very prosperous for Germany. You know, we're protecting you. You have to pay your bills.
So, Laura, the rule is that NATO members are expected to pay in 2% of their GDP. Germany, at this point, is just over 1%. Does the president have a point?
Well, it's not a hard and fast rule that this is something that Germany owes to NATO to spend 2% on its GDP. That's never been the case for any of these countries. But it is something that the Trump administration and actually the Obama administration before him has urged NATO allies to do, to spend more on defense, primarily to deter Russia. But it is really interesting in my reporting on this, I found that this decision completely blindsided the Pentagon last week. No one in the Pentagon, as far as I know, supports this move. It was completely a White House decision, and the generals are just being dragged along.
I want to interrupt you for just a second, because let's take a listen, actually, to the U.S. ambassador to NATO, Kay Bailey Hutchinson. CNN interviewed her this week and asked if she knew this was coming.
Well, I hadn't known of that specific announcement, but certainly I knew that the Joint Chiefs are always looking at where our bases are, where our troops are, where they are needed, and they're constantly assessing and reassessing.
So, Nick, how common is it? This is a major announcement if it goes forward. How common is it for those who are on the ground or working in those areas to not know it's coming?
It has been more common since January 2017 than in any time in U.S. history. You know, it is clear from the Bolton book and from everyone the three of us have spoken to over the last 3 years that there is a difference between Donald Trump and the Trump administration. And the Trump administration policy, whether the Pentagon, the State Department, most of the National Security Council, Lara is absolutely right. Everyone was blindsided. Germany was blindsided. And so this was taken without consultation. But what the argument is, to your point before, is not only that Germany hasn't hit 2%, but the president was personally ticked off, I've been told, when Chancellor Merkel said, hey, I'm not coming to your G7 meeting in Camp David. And we should put another but on this, just to make it more complicated. We may see these troops move from Germany to Poland. And the irony of that is that the Pentagon officials who Lara mentioned, all sorts of executive officials who we're all talking to think this is a terrible idea, in part because it kind of gives Russia more of a green light in Europe. But actually, if the troops move to Poland, we don't know if they will, what the Russian analysts I'm talking to are saying is actually that's more confrontational to Russia. So we see a disconnection within the bureaucracy from the president. We see a disconnection of the strategy from the president, and we just don't know how it's going to actually look in the end, because as the Pentagon didn't know, they're also slow rolling this, and so this could take a while to actually be executed.
Ishan, why are there 50,000 troops in Germany?
Well, this is one of the issues that Trump came into the White House and talked about. He does have a political objection to some of the legacy deployments that the United States has kept around the world for decades, since the end of the World War II and America's authoring of the sort of the liberal order of the 20th century. American troop placements in Germany have been there and really guaranteed European security for many years. And Trump also has similar issues with American deployments in South Korea, and has also, vis-a-vis American allies in South Korea, tried to essentially raise the bill for American troops there. And this is part of his broader worldview, which is shared both on the left and the right in the United States by various people, but not principally by anybody in Congress right now, or by very few people in Congress right now, that the U.S. doesn't need to be the world's policeman, even though it's played an incredibly positive role in Asia in terms of guaranteeing peace in the Asia Pacific over the decades. And you could argue that Europe has for many years leaned on the American security presence. What's happening right now, especially because of the erratic nature of Trump's diplomacy, is that there has emerged in the last half decade a more robust conversation within Europe about their need to, if not necessarily break away from the American umbrella, but be more able to fend for themselves and to stand up a bit more. And so there's talk in Paris and Berlin and elsewhere of a kind of, you know, new European security rubric that could see a new kind of European army. There's talk in general of raising military commitments. It is quite funny to hear Trump once again raise this claim that Germany is delinquent. This is one of the zombie fallacies of the presidency, because Germany is not delinquent, as Nick and Lara said earlier. But yet. This is all this talk and all of Trump's browbeating of NATO over the last few years has convinced many in Europe that they do need to take their security more into their own hands.
Let's move on to talk about the virus that is still spreading around the world. there is possibly some good news here. Doctors in the UK say we now have our first potentially life-saving coronavirus drugs. It's called dexamethasone. It is a low-cost, low-dose steroid treatment, and experts say that for people who are on ventilators, it cuts the risk of death from COVID-19 by up to a third. That is significant. But Nick, this is not a vaccine. What do we know about this particular medical breakthrough?
It is definitely not a vaccine, which we won't see at least until next year, probably, but it is a treatment. And that's a really important point, that we simply have not had anything, or doctors and scientists have not had anything to give to patients as they lay dying, as they have to get on ventilators, as they have to take oxygen, and the doctors simply have no way to prevent their death. And obviously many live, but there's just no intervention there. And so this would be the first treatment to reduce mortality. And, you know, the Brits who studied this say thousands of deaths could have been prevented if doctors had this from the beginning. And the reason that is that it reduces inflammation as the immune system responds to the coronavirus. So this doesn't necessarily remove the coronavirus. It actually deals with how we respond to the virus, which is deadly in itself. But, you know, we just don't know yet. But it's you know, very positive signs. And if this turns out to be true, if it's confirmed over the next few weeks and months, then yes, it would be the first treatment. It would really be a breakthrough, according to most doctors, in the ability to prevent people from dying from the coronavirus.
Ishan, I feel like I ask this every week in the roundup, but could you give us an update on where we stand in the quest for a vaccine?
I think it depends on who you're talking to. I don't think there's any confidence that a significantly effective vaccine will be distributed anytime this year. And of course, there's still pretty intense debates about how affordable that vaccine will be and how easy it can be distributed. So, you know, we're far away a ways. And then at the same time, there is a parallel debate about the viability of these herd immunity strategies that you're seeing in some parts of the world. And there's skepticism about the efficacy of that as well.
I'm sure those conversations will continue, since even if we do get a vaccine next year, as you mentioned, it would be much longer before we're able to dose everyone in the world and get it to all populations. There is news out of China, though, where the virus originated. More than 29 communities in China's capital city are back on lockdown because of another outbreak. And Nick, there were more than 100 new cases in Beijing recorded over the course of just one weekend. This does call into question, are we getting reliable data now out of China?
Well, that is a good question, and that's certainly what the U.S. is asking. And to put a little context on that, U.S. officials say that China underreported by a factor of 10. So where China said 4,000 people died in Wuhan, U.S. says it's 40,000 or 50,000. But the undercount is something that we've seen all over the world, frankly, and the U.S. is essentially guessing on that number. But in terms of this outbreak, yeah, we've got almost 200 infections now by the end of this week. And what Beijing is doing is doing what it did to a large extent earlier this year, which is mobilizing a police state. And so there are places in Beijing where you cannot leave your apartment complex. Now, there is some restraint that we're seeing in Beijing. Authorities are trying to minimize the widespreadness, for lack of a better word, of the crackdown. And so next to apartment buildings that are shut down, there are neighborhoods that are still open, you know, whereas in January and February, Wuhan completely shut down and the police state really mobilized. So the bigger fear is not whether China, I think, is telling us the number accurately, is that we're going to be dealing with these kinds of spikes, these kinds of second waves, these kinds of continuations of localized outbreaks for the foreseeable future. And the countries that have testing and tracing and plans are going to do better than the countries that have not developed that yet.
Ishan, Nick just alluded to the other places we are beginning to see a resurgence. Where is that happening? Because it's all over the globe.
We're in the scenario now where, as Nick pointed out, you're seeing these new clusters flare in places that so effectively a second wave in some places. But for many parts of the world, the first wave is not over. In the U.S., it's not over. And of course, in the last week or so, we've seen Brazil now rocket up to sort of the second place, sort of just below the United States in terms of COVID deaths. And in countries like Brazil, and especially in Peru and other parts of Latin America, the first wave is still exacting a really bitter toll. And in Brazil, and I think this is a country definitely worth paying attention to, the coronavirus has exacted itself in a similar way in the United States on incredibly in a very politicized, polarized environment. The Brazilian president, Jair Bolsonaro, has been perhaps the world's coronavirus skeptic in chief in many ways. He raged against lockdowns imposed by local state governors. He's clashed with his health authorities. And so you've seen a very uneven response there. And it's now, as many people forecast, it's now spreading in its major cities. It's also spreading in incredibly remote areas among Brazil's indigenous populations as well. So it's a real crisis in a country that's the size of a continent.
We should mention also that in South Korea, they halted some plans to reopen there. Lebanon ordered a four-day lockdown because of a spike in cases. And Germany has threatened to halt the reopening there as well because of a sudden resurgence in cases of COVID. But let's stay in Brazil because they're now reporting almost 35,000 new coronavirus infections. That is the highest daily total for a country whose COVID numbers seem to go up week after week. And that brings us back to exactly what Ishan was talking about. And it brings me kind of to the same question I had about China, which is, can we trust the numbers out of Brazil? We have gotten false information from that nation as well.
Look, I'll put a point on it. Something is rotten in Rio. I mean, that is clearly what has happened here. Jair Bolsonaro has not only denied it, as Ishan said, he said, oh, even if I get it, I'm so athletic, I won't be hit that much. Not only the indigenous, not only the favelas are being hit. We just simply have no idea how widespread the disease is in that country. We did a piece a few weeks ago where we interviewed an epidemiologist in Brazil who said there's just not enough testing. There's no testing. There's no visibility into what's happening. Multiple health ministers have been sacked because they didn't do what Bolsonaro said. And so the fear is that until the world can tackle COVID-19 in each of the hotspots, we will have to deal with this as a pandemic, as a medical crisis for the foreseeable future. And these political problems that we're seeing, and they are that, are going to limit the world's ability, as the world, to overcome this disease. And frankly, Brazil is probably the worst offender of that.
Let's talk about the situation in Yemen, Lara, because things have gone, I think it's fair to say, from bad to worse. More than 2 million Yemenis have contracted COVID-19. The medical system is not in good shape, and nearly a fourth of the country is malnourished. Experts fear that the outbreak will spread rapidly there. Why has Yemen in particular been hit so hard?
Yeah, Yemen is just a really, really tragic situation. There's actually been some progress in Yemen recently with the civil war there, with the United Arab Emirates recently backing out, saying that they weren't going to take part in the Saudi-led coalition anymore. But of course, the war has sparked the world's worst humanitarian crisis, even well before COVID started. There was a cholera outbreak a couple of years ago, you know, millions of people displaced and starving. It's just a tragic, tragic situation. But of course, now you have COVID, and Yemen is really the perfect place for a virus like this to spread. All the infrastructure for its healthcare system has just been completely depleted. People's immune systems are down because of starvation, malnutrition, cholera, like I said. So the epidemic of COVID could completely eclipse all the recent gains that I just mentioned, and this just adds to the horrible suffering of civilians across the country.
I wonder, Laura, before the coronavirus, we were talking about the proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Could we see another ceasefire there?
I certainly think at least before COVID, it was possible. There was some progress made toward that position, especially as Iran has kind of backed off its aggressive stance in the world in recent months after a series of standoffs with the U.S. Over outposts in Iraq, and then the shoot down of the commercial airliner that Iran had to eventually take credit for, and of course the death of Qasem Soleimani that President Trump took credit for. So yes, I think we could see some sort of ceasefire. I think Iran is probably pretty desperate for some good news here.
Let's talk about Syria. This week, the United States introduced new economic and travel sanctions that are aimed at the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad. Laura, what is happening here?
So this is really notable because these are the toughest sanctions yet to be imposed on the Syrian regime. They specifically target 39 individuals, including Bashar al-Assad, his wife, and some other officials. And this is supposed to be a part of a renewed pressure campaign against Assad and his backers, Iran and Hezbollah. So specifically, it penalizes any company that deals with Assad and also blocks reconstruction assistance from Washington. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has said the goal of these sanctions is to force Assad into accepting UN Security Council Resolution 2254 from 2015, which called for a ceasefire in the war, elections, and a political transition in Syria. Now, it's important to note that the Assad regime right now is already really squeezed. The Syrian economy is already shattered due to the war, widespread food and medicine shortages, and now fears about COVID. The Syrian currency actually plunged by up to 44% ahead of the sanctions implementation recently, and protests against the regime have gained momentum as well. These sanctions in particular are named for the pseudonym of a Syrian who smuggled out pictures of people who were tortured by the Assad regime, so there's a symbolic significance there as well. And it's really notable that this is happening now. The Syrian regime should be held accountable for what they've done to the Syrian people. Over 700,000 people killed, 10 million people displaced. But at the same time, there is still more that needs to be done. The international community needs to increase humanitarian aid and stabilization funding to the areas that are liberated from the regime, and particularly the northeast region where there's prisons and refugee camps that really need help.
Ishan, sanctions are always a little complicated in that they are often directed at governments and in response to decisions by a government, and yet they end up impacting the people. And so the Syrian people will be impacted by these sanctions. What do we know about how that might play out within the country?
Well, we know that this is going to make it harder for the Syrian government, the Assad regime, to procure oil and gas. It's going to raise, and that's going to obviously have a spiraling effect and trickle down on the rest of Syrian society. It's going to raise prices, make food more expensive, and in general, further squeeze the quality of life in a country that's in a pretty miserable state of affairs. And what's important to recognize about what these sanctions represent, and there's been a lot of congressional pressure to enact them over the past year, is that in Washington there is a recognition that, yes, the Assad regime has essentially won the war, this miserable decade-long civil war, but we're going to make it as hard as possible for them to win the peace. Mm. And they may very well succeed in really squeezing the regime, but that's going to obviously have trickle-down effects on the civilian populace that's already suffered and experienced quite a lot.
Nick, what has been the response from other nations within the Middle East? Iran condemned the sanctions, but the past has shown us that the Middle Eastern nations aren't always enthusiastic about U.S. decision-making and interference, how they see it in that region.
Well, the response has fallen along the lines that you'd expect. Assad's allies, including Iran, have opposed them, and the people who are with the United States against Assad are in favor of them. And so, you know, what we're seeing right now, as Ishan mentioned right at the end there, you know, is whether Assad can win the peace. But I would go farther than that. You know, Charles Lister, who's an excellent Syria watcher, just penned a column saying, will Assad fall? There are real questions about the aspects that Lara raised. There's a split among the Alawites, the ruling party. There's Druze who are now openly opposed to Assad. The collapse of the currency, Lebanon's collapse, and what U.S. officials say is some weakening in Russian support. So there is a level of weakness in Assad that we haven't seen before that the proponents of the Caesar bill are using to say, hey, we can finally turn the tide in this war. We can finally, at the very least, get rid of Assad. What the critics of the Caesar bill say is that this is not enough to change his behavior. If Assad's willing to gas his own people, he's willing to put up with these latest sanctions and also the changes that have happened over the last few weeks that have weakened him, and therefore will only hurt Syrian civilians as he doubles down and triples down and quadruples down, whatever the number is at this point, to try and save his own skin. So there is a robust debate happening about these bills. It is no doubt that Assad is weaker, but it's very, very unclear that he's about to fall.
It seems like we have to talk about North Korea again. The grand opening of the Inter-Korean Liaison Office 2 years ago was a big deal, both symbolic and literally. It was meant to reflect improving relationships between North and South Korea, heavily covered. North Korea blew it up. Laura, why?
So this incident is highly symbolic. The office was meant to facilitate dialogue between the two Koreas and paid for by the South and sitting on the North soil. So North Korea framed the decision to destroy the office as retaliation after a group of defectors used balloons to send anti-North Korean propaganda and leaflets north of the DMZ. But this is really just the latest escalation in these tensions after North Korea last week also announced that it would cut off all communications with the South as well in response to the leaflets. In addition, the North also said it would remilitarize portions of the border that had been peaceful in recent years. So this is really a bad sign that relations between the North and the South are in a very bad place right now. And this is particularly disappointing for Korea watchers after President Trump and South Korean President Moon actually had made some progress in negotiations with the North over the last few years, at least in appearance anyway. Even though the Singapore summit in 2018, the agreement was mostly symbolic, it still sort of paved the way for this dialogue to continue. But unfortunately, that's really gone downhill since then. And at the same time, there are recent reports that are popping up that are saying North Korea has been ramping up its nuclear weapons arsenal. Yeah. And last year it broke an 18-month hiatus in weapons tests, conducting 18, I think, tests of mostly short-range ballistic missiles since then.
So, Ishan, Kim Yo-jong, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's sister, has taken responsibility for this attack, for blowing up the liaison. What do we know about her? Why would she do this?
She's his sister, and for quite some time she's been in the sidelines. Korea watchers would sort of parse state photos and see where she's standing, and for a long time she was this figure shrouded in mystery. Now she's come to the fore, and she's been quite a dramatic presence in all this. She seemed to be a bit more ruthless than her brother, and there is a great deal of speculation about the kind of role she's currently playing within the regime in Pyongyang. And how much influence she has, or how much growing influence she has. I think her coming to the fore is important. The move to blow up this office in Kaesong is, as Lara was saying, a huge political blow to Moon Jae-in, the South Korean president, who's really yoked his legitimacy and his political aspirations on a real thaw with the North. And that seems to be in a tough place right now. And of course, this explosion also kind of very symbolically blows up what already faded aspirations the Trump administration had, that its efforts, including these incredibly publicized photo ops between Trump and Kim Jong-un, it really blows up, it really underscores the hollowness of the Trump plan to get North Korea to denuclearize.
So, Nick, let's talk a little bit about these denuclearization talks. As Lara mentioned, there were some signs that progress might be made. They were mostly symbolic, but people had I don't want to say high hopes, but they had hopes. Is that all dashed now? Has that been blown up as well?
I think there were hopes among the president and some of his allies that this top-down photo op diplomacy, Singapore, Hanoi, DMZ, stepping into North Korea, would somehow shift Kim Jong-un's strategic calculus of himself and the world, that a good relationship with the United States president would somehow change decades of North Korean policy. And you could probably hear in my voice the skepticism that most North Korea experts had of this, as well as, according to John Bolton, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo believed that this was doomed to fail. And so the 2018 momentum that Moon Jae-in absolutely led, that President Trump went along with, was probably dead before. And so this just symbolizes that that effort is just not going anywhere, because North Korea has been looking for sanctions relief. Yeah. That's the main thing that it has been pushing, and that is the main thing the United States is not willing to give. And so in this building being blown up, you see North Korea, one, doing some domestic work and elevating the sister of Kim Jong-un, as we just talked about.
Yeah.
And two, pressuring South Korea to try and get them to pressure Washington right. to get some sanctions relief, and that's just not happening.
Laura, is there any discussion over what his sister's actions, and as she comes to the fore, is there discussion over whether this means anything about the strength or weakness of Kim Jong-un's leadership?
I think certainly there is speculation, as there always is, about the strength of Kim Jong-un's leadership. I think that she's certainly being put in a position to at least help her brother, potentially be a potential successor to her brother. As you know, there was some speculation a couple weeks or months ago about Kim Jong-un's health, actually. Mm-hmm. So this fact that the sister now is reappearing is an interesting sign that things might not all be well in North Korea. And of course, yeah. they, as you know, have been really hit by an epidemic of COVID as well. So I think with North Korea always, there's a lot that's still in the shadows.
Now, on Monday, just this week, a judge found Filipino journalist Maria Ressa guilty of cyber libel. Ressa was arrested early last year in the Manila offices of Rappler. That is an online news outlet that she founded. It drew a lot of attention because of its very tough and tenacious coverage of Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte. Ishan, what stands out for you in this?
It's pretty alarming. Maria Ressa is a known entity. A respected journalist who presided over Rappler, which is a respected news outlet. The Philippines is a country in Asia I've spent a lot of time reporting there that has a vibrant civil society, a hurly-burly press. And this is part of a real chilling effect instituted by President Rodrigo Duterte, who in many ways is taking his cues from President Trump here. He's labeled the critical press, the fake news. And this case is a pretty complicated case involving certain technical breaches that have allowed the court to impose this sentence on Maria Ressa. But it certainly represents a dark moment for Filipino democracy, and suggests that Duterte's government is really pushing the envelope in terms of trying to exert more influence and control over Filipino civil society.
Nick, this is one headline out of many that we've seen that relates to press freedom just within recent years. Is it harder for journalists like the three of you to do your jobs overseas?
Well, it depends on where you're talking about. If the question is less about the three of us and more about local journalists, the answer is absolutely yes. I mean, Duterte is a perfect example of someone who, as Ishan knows well, has snuffed out critical press. I mean, he closed.
We just lost Nick there. Laura, do you want to finish that sentence or that sentiment?
Yes, I mean, I certainly think, as Nick was saying, that Duterte is a perfect example of someone who has really cracked down on the press recently, an effort to silence independent journalism around the world. This is, you'll also note this in China and Iran, but particularly China recently with the COVID epidemic. There's been many reports that doctors and local press were silenced in their efforts to get out the word about COVID. So it certainly is a tough time to be a local journalist anywhere. And honestly, even in the United States, Duterte and President Trump have that in common. They both have quite a combative relationship with the media since coming into power. And Duterte has attacked journalists as spies and warned that they could be targeted for assassination. So it's certainly a worrying time to be a journalist around the world right now.
We only have about 20, 30 seconds left. Nick, did you want to finish the sentence that you started?
Sorry about that. I got disconnected. Well, just to repeat what Laura just said at the end, it's incredibly difficult in the Philippines to be a journalist. But I was talking to the Committee on Public Protect Journalists, Asia especially, all around the region. We have seen a crackdown on journalism, and we have seen the embrace across the world of the two words that the authoritarians now use, fake news, to combat any bad journalism.
Big thanks to Nick Schifrin, foreign affairs and defense correspondent for the PBS NewsHour, also Laura Seligman, Pentagon reporter with Politico, and from the Washington Post, Ishan Tharoor. Ishan's a columnist on the Foreign Desk and runs the Today's Worldview newsletter for the Post. 1A's senior producers are Danielle Knight and Paige Osborne. Our sound engineer and designer is Jake Cherry. Matthew Simonson produces our podcast from his home in the great state of Colorado. This program comes to you from my house and WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great weekend. Stay safe. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.